Afternoon and welcome to the Colorado Court of Appeals. We have two cases set for argument, Colorado Regional Construction and Wise. Counselor to set up and ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor.
Have counsel checked in our second case, which is Taylor v. ICAO? Thank you. Have counsel in CRC read our written statements of procedure, and do you have any questions? Before we go on the clock, in this case, we have an appeal and a cross appeal. If either of you have made any agreements as to the time, that's fine. It's 15 minutes aside. My assumption is that the cross appellant may want to reserve some time to have the last word, but only on the cross appeal. So if you do so, your last word is only on the cross appeal, and the appellant has the last word on the appealed issues. Okay, on that basis, we're ready for argument. And I've never been in this room before, so if something doesn't work right, blame me.
Well, it's down. May it please the court. My name is Wendy Weigler, registration number 28419, and I represent the appellants, Colorado Regional Construction, which I will refer to as CRC. This appeal was brought to address several serious errors by the trial court, an overly harsh and disproportionate sanction order that stripped CRC of its defenses and left it unable to defend itself at trial, and a pretrial ruling that allowed an unlicensed plumber not only to proceed with his case despite half a century of case law to the contrary, but ultimately to be awarded with actual and treble damages and attorney's fees. Immediately prior to trial, CRC learned that Wheezy Company had performed its work without a plumber's license in violation of Colorado's plumbing statutes. Relying on decades of Colorado precedent directly on point, including the 1956 Supreme Court decision of Carter v. Tompkins, cited in my brief, we filed an emergency motion to dismiss, since the cases are clear that an unlicensed plumber is barred from recovering for services that required a license under any theory of recovery. Rather than address the issue on the merits, the trial judge denied the motion on procedural grounds, despite the fact that she herself had concerns about the legality of the contract.
You're basically raising the defense of illegality under Rule 8C.
Well, that was what the trial court found. But we argued to the contrary, that it's not simply the defense of illegality, that we did raise as a defense a statutory violation, the failure to comply with applicable statutes. Under the case law that we cited, the lack of a license actually deprived the Wheezy, the plumber, from having standing to be heard in court. So it was, it's not so much an affirmative defense as it was a question of whether, as a matter of law, the plaintiff had the right to proceed, aside from anything that the defendants had to do with it.
Swaggle, can I ask you, and I recognize that you're saying you did plead, and you did plead the statutory violation, at least in your answer. You didn't in the trial management order, correct?
That's correct. The by agreement of counsel, the discovery cutoff deadline was extended, and we ended up having the deposition of the principal of Wheezy Company. Let's see, it was on February 13th, and trial began on February 26th.
That was after the TMO?
It was.
Was there any effort to amend the TMO?
No. What we did immediately, or as soon as possible, the deposition was on the 13th. We filed the motion on the 19th.
Now, let me ask, I do understand you take the position that you can't waive this kind of illegality position. But let's put that aside for a minute. I guess I'm trying to square how you read 8C, which says illegality. I guess you want to say, well, it's a statutory violation. Well, you say it's the statutory violation made this contract illegal. Aside from the waiver issue for a moment, that you can't waive it, don't you have to plead illegality? I mean, 8C specifically says it's an affirmative defense. And I'm a little bit concerned with a rule that would say, well, since it was a statutory violation that happened also to be illegality, you can avoid Rule 8C.
Right. And I don't think that that's precisely it. I think that there are different ways that you can have the defense of illegality. And maybe illegality is not the right name for what we have here. Maybe statutory violation is not the right name, word for phrase for what we have. But what we have is a professional who's required to have a license proceeding without a license. And the way I read all of those cases, that person was not authorized to go into court based on that. And it wasn't about the defenses. And the Potter v. Swinehart case was the one that said it doesn't matter how it's pled. It doesn't matter how it comes up from the plaintiff or defendant. What matters that it's out there, that it's disclosed by the evidence, and that's sufficient.
I'll get off your case here in a minute. But wasn't there some evidence or wasn't there disputed evidence about whether Wheezy was or was not licensed? I mean, I recognize, you know, first there was, well, I thought we had a master plumber on or a license. Then you have this deposition later in the game. Isn't that for the trial judge to make that credibility determination?
Perhaps, but she didn't do it, and she didn't allow that process to even happen. There was an allegation that there was another gentleman who was supposed to be the master plumber. If we were allowed to pursue this area at the hearing, at the trial, or at a separate hearing, none of the defendants had ever heard of the person. He'd never been on the job site. There was evidence out there, and the trial judge did find that she didn't find the testimony of the plaintiff to be believable on that point. So at the very minimum, there should have been a hearing. There should have been evidence. They went on, well, the person from the license department or from the Grand County came in and said, well, yes, I had checked and they were licensed. I mean, there needed to be something further than that. And I think at the very least, what the trial judge should have done was to not require us to proceed at that point, but perhaps have a hearing on that issue. But we were deprived that opportunity.
Let's assume, solely for purposes of my question, that this is an affirmative defense. The trial court struck all of your client's affirmative defenses. If we hold that ruling to be within the trial court's discretion, isn't that the end of the unlicensed plumber issue?
I believe it is.
Thank you.
And that's why that leads me into my next argument, why that order should not be upheld. And that order itself, we believe that was an abuse of the court's discretion that presents its own independent reason, aside from the license issues or any of the affirmative defenses issues. It's an independent reason for reversal of the judgment of the trial court. Neither the circumstances of this case nor binding precedent of this court or of the Colorado Supreme Court supports the trial court's decision to strike CRC's affirmative defenses and counterclaim. The punishment simply did not fit the crime. The crime in this case was the late filing of initial disclosures after the court had imposed a deadline on CRC when they were proceeding pro se. As soon as practicable, after CRC retained counsel, my services, we provided the required disclosures. The plaintiffs did not complain about the sufficiency of the disclosures. They did not move to compel additional disclosures. Instead, they sought sanctions under Rule 37. Despite the fact that the plaintiffs failed to demonstrate any prejudice from the late disclosures, especially because the original trial date was continued and the discovery period was extended, so any possible prejudice was cured by those actions.
Weigler, can I ask you two related questions on this? And I was going to ask your colleagues, so I'll warn them about what the prejudice was. First of all, I'm troubled. They first moved for sanctions of, was it dismissal or judgment? I can't remember. And the court said, no, that's too severe. Maybe there's an interim sanction. They then moved for the kind of lesser sanction of striking your defenses, and you all didn't respond. And so I'd be ask you if you would address why not, and why can't the judge say without a response from you, accept what they did? Second question on this is, as a factual matter, what evidence or defense did you not get to put on, you know, at the trial? I recognize, you know, as a technical matter, struck your affirmative defenses, but it did seem like you got to defend. So I'm curious what you think you did were not allowed to do at the trial.
Okay.
So those two questions, if you would.
Okay. The first question, we did not file a timely response to the second motion. And it was mainly an oversight due to the timing of how it had all occurred.
Was CRC represented by counsel at the time of the failure to respond?
Yes.
Thank you. I apologize for interrupting.
No problem. The second motion for sanctions was filed on December 10th. I was out of the country from December 8th through December 21st. And through the timing of it all, I realized, obviously, when the court granted the motion on January 1st, that the response would have been due 2 days prior on December 29th. With the vacation and the holidays, it was an oversight. That's all it was. Under those circumstances, though, it was clear that we did object to the motion because counsel had conferred and we stated we objected. It was virtually identical to the prior motion where we very clearly laid out our position why lesser sanctions were appropriate. So that's basically how that occurred. Now, the second question about evidence, it was difficult all along to know what evidence we could put on and what we were not allowed to put on. It was a very difficult situation to be in, to know what was merely defensive and what was affirmative defense.
Couldn't you always put in evidence that the work was substandard?
We could, but she did not allow us to put in evidence of a very crucial fact that they had to hire somebody new to come in and fix all of the work that was done, and that's why that money went to pay the new person.
That's a matter of counterclaim, not a matter of defense. I mean, you could have put in a defense that the plumbing fell apart in people's hands, it leaked when they tried to turn it on, so the work was bad, correct?
Right. I mean, to some extent we could, and to a large extent we couldn't, because of the nature that, whether it's a counterclaim or considered set off, we were prohibited. From moment to moment and witness to witness, we didn't really know what we were able to proceed with.
Were there any specific instances, Ms. Weigler, where you tried? You know, you asked for a bench conference to see, can we go this far, and the judge said no? Or was it just kind of an assumption that maybe we shouldn't push the limit here?
Well, first of all, it was a trial to the court. So, you know, there was no jury to be worried about. I cited in my opening brief, in regards to the third issue, numerous record sites where I went through the transcript and found those places where I felt that we tried to introduce evidence and it was objected and not allowed. And that's in response to, that relates to the issue of the construction trust fund violation.
Well, let me come back to my question. Did you present evidence that the lien should be disallowed or the amount reduced because the work was substandard?
We attempted to put on evidence.
That wasn't my question. Was any evidence on that subject offered and admitted?
Yes, there was testimony.
Okay, thank you.
Running out of time here, I conclude that the judgment of the trial court should be reversed, but not necessarily remanded to try the issues again. If the court does agree with our position on the plumbing license issue, then Wheezy's claim should be dismissed as a matter of law. Thank you.
Are you going to be sharing time?
No, Your Honor, I will be taking all the time. May it please the court. I'm Doug Perko, attorney for the intervener plaintiff, Mart Supply Company. At council table with me is Vern Evans, counsel for plaintiff Wheezy Company. Because Wheezy and Mart's positions and arguments are substantially the same, but as Mart's has additional issues, I'll be taking the full time to argue for on behalf of the plaintiff's side. Initially, I would like to address with the court the issues raised on the cross appeal, and then I will address arguments presented in Wheezy and Mart's answer briefs and to answer any questions of the court thereon. The plaintiffs are before this court asking that this court reverse the ruling of the trial court dismissing claim two, the claim on the lien release bonds. The trial court erred as a matter of law in dismissing this second claim mid-trial, and the trial court so erred in determining that proof of a recording of Liz Pendens was an element of this second claim, and proof of such recording was required for this type of bond claim. Had there been no lien release bonds filed in this case, then the second claim's elements would be for a lien foreclosure claim against the property owners of the particular property that was liened. And those elements would include, one, proof of the underlying contract or debt amount owed to Wheezy for the work and materials it incorporated into the involved real property via CRC's principal contracts with the owners of these sites of real property. Two, timely compliance with applicable subsections of section 38-22-109. Three, timely commencement of a lien foreclosure action under section 38-22-110. And if the real property were still an issue in this case and the owners were parties to this case, owners of the real property, for compliance with the recording of a notice of pendency of action requirement under that same section 110.
Any dispute that no such notice was filed?
Well, there
by you by
there's
you.
No proof. The court required proof, and proof was not presented at trial, although one was filed or one was recorded.
For purposes of the record, there was no proof that it had been filed.
That's correct.
Thank you.
Now, the trial court finds that there is evidence presented on these elements 1, 2, and 3 that I just listed, and that those elements are satisfied in this case. However, the trial court determined that proof of a recorded Liz Pendens was an applicable requirement to a bond claim, a substituted bond claim. However, with the filing of the lien release bonds in this case, a notice of pendency of action is not an essential requirement of that bond claim.
That's an unresolved question in Colorado law. It's not addressed by the statute or any case.
Correct? That's correct, Your Honor. And we are arguing that particular element or proof of recording of a notice of Liz Pendens is superfluous and futile in the situation where lien release bonds have been substituted for the mechanics liens.
I know, Mr. Parker, you relied on out-of-state cases to support this argument, one of which was this Linden-Sprungley case out of New York. Is that your best case? What's your best out-of-state case supporting your argument?
I think that is both of those cases that we cited from the New York appellate decisions are probably the most applicable and most persuasive cases.
But aren't those distinguishable? I mean, I've got Linton-Sprungley in my hand. The court specifically noted that under the New York statute, the filing of a lease pendens after the release of it was prohibited by the statute.
Well, if you actually read the other case, the White Plains Sash and Door case, that case discusses that same statute and says there's a conflict in there. At one point, it says you have to still record notice of Liz Pendens, and then you don't have to. And they said to resolve that conflict, we're going to find that the recording of a Liz Pendens is not required in the circumstance where mechanics liens have been released and substituted by these lien release bonds. So in essence, that White Plains case resolves what they say is an inherent conflict in that statute, which the mechanics lien statute, but for that one section you read out of the New York statute, is very similar to the Colorado statute in terms of a requirement for a timely filing of a notice of lien within X amount of time of the recordation of the lien and of the lien statement and the filing of a notice of lis pendens. When we release the property, when the owners of the property are dismissed as parties from the case, then the lien or the recording of a lis pendens becomes a nullity or not a necessity in these matters, as the cases that the plaintiff's briefs have cited in terms of the purpose of a notice of lis pendens requirement state. The purpose of the lis pendens is to put the public and potential purchasers of a property on notice that that particular property and the owner of that property are subject to a lien foreclosure claim that's currently pending. With the release of the real property from the case to where the real property cannot provide any potential recovery or remedy in the case, the need for the notice of lis pendens in terms of proceeding on the bond claim is really rendered nugatory.
Give you a scenario where on the basis of which I would disagree. Under 3822.129.5, if the surety becomes insolvent, as I read it, the property then could still be subject to the lien.
Well, and that is probably a correct interpretation of that statute.
However, okay, well, wouldn't then that mean the prospective purchaser would want to know if there were lien claims pending against the property?
Well,
even though they'd been bonded over?
In that circumstance, if they have been bonded over, it's likely that we're going to have a certificate of release. And as the court did in this case, in part of the of order of approving of the filing of the bonds, and any sort of lis pendens that had been filed will be released, and a party would have to probably go before the court and get permission to file a notice of lis pendens at that time, because the document itself, the effect of the any recorded notice of lis pendens prior to the certificate of release would it would no longer be effective upon that certificate of release being recorded.
Why would a certificate of release of the lien wipe out a lis pendens?
Well, because it tells the parties that the bonds are now subject to the security for the case. The real property is no longer, and that's what happened in this case. It specifically, all of the trial court's orders noted that Wheezy's mechanics liens were released. The certificate of release furthered that and indicated also that the defendants, all defendants other than CRC were being dismissed from the case. Now, in connection with the superfluous nature of the notice of lis pendens in a circumstance like this case where lien bonds have been substituted for the mechanics lien, any type of notice there would also be futile in the sense that it likely would be in violation of the Colorado spurious lien statute. When the court has ordered that the property is released from the case and the owners are no longer defendants in the case, any type of filing to meet this requirement would be in violation of the spurious lien statute.
Doesn't the spurious lien statute absolute filing of the
I think the two cases that I cited in the brief indicate that a notice of lis pendens is covered by the spurious lien statute, and I don't think that just because a statutory provision provides for or allows for recording of a notice of lis pendens that you cannot be found in violation of that statute, particularly when court orders have entered releasing the property, releasing the mechanics liens, and providing for recordation of that information. In addition, the requirement that the trial court imposed here for proof of a recording of lis pendens and the defendant's argument in that regard are contrary to the liberal and equitable construction that is supposed to be given to the Colorado mechanics lien statutes as required by the Colorado Supreme Court in its Compass Bank decision from 2005, where the court noted that this construction is given to avoid needless and inequitable loss of mechanics and materialmen's security interests as provided for by the statute. Here, the law does not provide or does not require the performance of a feudal act to assert an important right, being the right to proceed against these bonds. The imposition of the requirement or the proof element of a recording of a notice of lis pendens in the circumstances of this case is, in fact, a feudal act that the law should not require. And as indicated by the New York appellate decisions, who have looked at this specifically, that that is not a requirement for proceeding in the case for a plaintiff or claimant who at one time had a claim under a mechanics lien that had been released. The claim is then shifted to the bond, and the bond doesn't require proof of notice of lis pendens. Moreover, even if proof of notice of lis pendens or some notice of pendency was a requirement on the bond substitution claim in this case, there was proof here. The plaintiffs properly and timely asked the court to take judicial notice of CRC's admission in its answer to the complaint and intervention that CRC itself recorded notice of bonding being furnished for the project. And we submit that the trial court abused its discretion in not accepting this admission. However, on this point, we would ask the court to reverse the trial court's motion or order granting the motion to dismiss mid-trial and remand this with direction for entry of judgment in favor of the plaintiffs on claim number two.
Mr. Parko, you may be have to move on. You're going to run out of time, and I'm very interested in your response to some of Ms. Weigler's arguments.
Certainly.
So rather than my interrupting you three times, I'll tell you what my three concerns are, and then I'll shut up and let you speak. I would like you, if you would, to address the issue of the waiver of the illegality, this affirmative defense, because they didn't use the word illegal. I am concerned, or it seems to me, that the pleading a statutory violation should well have put you on sufficient notice. I'm throwing out the hypothetical for you to respond to. Why wasn't it enough that they pled the statutory violation? And so I'd be interested in your response to that. I'd be interested in your addressing Equitex, which says neither party may waive an objection based on illegality, that it can be raised. And I would be interested in your addressing this issue of the sanctions, the striking of the affirmative defenses for the discovery violation. I can't see and did not see in your brief how you were prejudiced by the late disclosures here. So those three points, if you would.
If I can do that
in
less than a minute.
And feel free to ask me to remind you, and I promise I will.
The first point you were asking about in connection with whether or not there could be a waiver, or was there a sufficient enough statement of a statutory violation? The answer did not allege a statutory violation. What they alleged was a failure to comply with statutory conditions. So what we were looking at in terms of that particular allegation was a potential contention that Wheezy had not complied with all of the requirements of the mechanics lien statute in perfecting its lien. We had no idea that there was some allegation of an alleged illegal contract. To address Judge Gabriel's other question relative to Equitech's case, first off, this court in Dinosaur Park Investments versus Tello said specifically, as required expressly by Rule 8C, those type of defenses have to be stated or they are waived. Now, that might seem to be in conflict with the case of Equitex, but Equitex was based not on a statutory violation, but it was based on an alleged allegation of violation of public policy where indemnification is prohibited on claims for or damages for claims involving intentional or willful wrongful conduct. It was a public policy argument, not a statutory violation argument. And if you will allow me to go on, or I can finish the question.
Judge Gabriel asked you three questions. Why don't you briefly respond to the third one, and I'll allow your adversary a couple extra minutes.
And your final question was as to what prejudice occurred to the plaintiffs in connection with the sanction rulings, or that would be basis or justification for the sanction
rulings.
The
fact rulings. That they were disclosed just relate.
Right. I would just point out to the court that Todd versus Bear Valley Village Apartments, that case by the Colorado Supreme Court states that the burden was on CRC to establish that its violations of the discovery disclosure rules and its violation of a court order to comply with a court order, it was the burden of proof on that party to show that those failures were either substantially justified or harmless. It did not meet that burden. However, the plaintiffs did show throughout the course of the case how they were being prejudiced by any late or insufficient disclosures by having the difficulty to prepare for trial. We received documents disclosed for the first time by CRC 13 days before trial, over 130 pages of documents. This was a continuing course of conduct of this particular party, this litigant, deciding if and when it was going to obey the court's order to disclose, and if and when it was going to comply with the disclosure requirements imposed on any litigant in Colorado. And so that particular culpable conduct continued on all the way up right before trial, and in fact has a bit of an expression in the fact that this motion to dismiss was filed a mere 6 days right on the eve of trial. And clearly the plaintiffs were prejudiced in that respect, because had any sort of disclosure or this argument ever been properly pled and presented or disclosed, Wheezy and Martz would have been able to call the gentleman who is the licensed plumber, who is the master licensed plumber under which Wheezy did its work on the project, and which, by the way, the evidence in this record shows without equivocation that the contractor licensing manager of the Grand County Building Department testified without equivocation that she checked and confirmed Wheezy was covered by a master's plumbing license at the time of the project, and a copy of that license was provided to the building department.
Thanks, Mr. Perko.
Thank you.
We have 2 minutes left. I'll let you.
Thank you. With regard to the
box now been adjusted, so okay, when the red light comes on, you're done.
Okay. With regard to the cross appeal on the issue of the list pendants and the mechanics lien statute, the mechanics lien statute is required to be strictly construed when you're talking about the validity of a lien. The cases that I cited make it very clear that you still have to comply with all of the statutory requirements required to foreclose a lien before being able to proceed against a bond. I don't believe the court should read something into the Colorado statutes that's not in there until that statute is changed or until they're, I'm sorry, until unless the statute is changed by the legislature. Going back to the sanctions issue, this court really only has to compare the situations in our case to the situations before the Colorado Supreme Court in the Pinkstaff versus Black and Decker case, which was decided while this appeal was pending. And in that case, it's almost unbelievable what had gone on, the comments that the trial judge made about counsel's behavior and all of the discovery failures, the flagrant disregard of court orders, the allegations of that counsel was in contempt of court. And even under those egregious circumstances, the Supreme Court found that it was still too harsh to strike the defendant's answer and affirmative defenses because it wasn't proportional.
But isn't that case distinguishable because striking the answer is the equivalent of a default judgment, whereas, as you acknowledge in response to earlier questions, you did present some evidence of a defense?
Correct. But the there was language in that case that it's not just that they couldn't defend at all, but that they were not permitted to present affirmative defenses. So for that reason, there's a similarity there. And obviously, the circumstances in our case are much less compelling than what existed in the Pinkstaff case. I have nothing further. Thank you.
All right. The time is exhausted. The case stands submitted. Counsel are excused. A written opinion will issue in due course. Counsel.